Fatherless Fanny by Anonymous. Chapter 28. A Mournful Story. My mother was the sole heiress to an immense fortune, with the title and estates of a dukedom entailed upon her eldest son. Her mother was sister to Lord Summertown, and it was always the design of that avaricious and vindictive nobleman to unite his son to my mother. She was accordingly kept very much secluded in the early part of her life, to prevent her forming any attachment before Lord Sheldon returned from his travels. This very precaution, however, was the occasion of her doing so, for in the retirement she lived in with her governess, she became acquainted with my father, who was then just inducted into the living of D., the village adjacent to Kennington Park, the seat where my mother resided. Whether the governess countenanced the attachment, I cannot tell, but be that as it may, the consequence was a clandestine marriage, and when Lord Sheldon came home to claim his bride, she confessed herself already the wife of another. It is impossible to describe the rage and fury of Lord Summertown when informed of his niece's delinquency. He vowed the most unrelenting vengeance, and immediately took every step to punish Mr. Eveline, her unfortunate husband, and distress Lady Lucy, which was my mother's name. A process was commenced against him in the Court of Chancery for stealing an heiress, and although by the testimony of my mother it was proved beyond a doubt that the act was entirely her own, and his life thereby preserved, yet the expenses incurred by the lawsuit, ill agreeing with his narrow circumstances, he was thrown into prison, where he languished the remaining years of my mother's minority. Nor was her confinement less rigid than her husband's, as she was kept a close prisoner by her inexorable guardian, and every motion strictly watched, lest she should convey any assistance to my father. My birth, which happened a few months after the discovery of the fatal secret, increased my mother's distress, and the terror lest I should fall into the merciless hands of her uncle nearly proved fatal to her during her lying in. I escaped the jaws of the lion, and was conveyed by a faithful servant of my mother's to a safe asylum. My father had a sister who was married to a Mr. Hamilton, but who, together with her husband, was abroad at this trying moment. To her my father had written an account of everything relating to his unhappy marriage, excepting his pecuniary embarrassments, a jail being preferable in his eyes to the idea of dependence. His pathetic description of Lady Lucy's situation, and his account of Lord Summertown's cruelty, alarmed his sister, and she wrote immediately to a friend she could rely upon, and desired her to find means to inform my mother that there was a friend she might safely trust, ready to receive her child, should she wish to place it out of the reach of her cruel uncle. My mother most thankfully embraced the offer, and I was accordingly torn from my weeping parents' bosom and conveyed to the asylum that had been prepared for me. Lord Summertown was outrageous when he found his victim had escaped him, and he spared no pains nor expense to find out my retreat. In this, however, he was disappointed, for my watchful friend had me conveyed to my aunt at Jamaica as soon as my tender age admitted of my undertaking such a journey. There I remained until my mother came of age, at which period she effected her escape from the confinement in which she had been kept upwards of 4 years. The first use she made of her liberty was to restore that of my father, and they were remarried at St. George's, Hanover Square, in the most public manner possible. The immense fortune to which they now acceded promised them every enjoyment this life can afford. But all their pleasures seemed imperfect whilst separated from their beloved child. My aunt, at this time, returned to England and came to reside at this very house. In this place, I was first conscious of the embraces of my parents, and had I no other reason, that single recollection would endear Pemberton Abbey to my heart. I was soon, however, removed to the splendid seat of my ancestors, and became the prime object of solicitude to all those that surrounded me. And I must here candidly confess that had the sunshine of prosperity continued unclouded, the very essence of my being would have been lost in slothful insanity of mind, and the best feelings of my heart stifled by a selfish regard to my own convenience. But I was intended for a life of trial, and my sufferings commenced at an early period. My mother, who had always been extremely delicate, died when I was no more than 12 years old, and my father was immediately involved in a chancery suit by a claimant to the estate and title to which I was lawful heir. Lord Somertown's malice to my mother, which survived her, induced him to support the claims of this pretender, and as his lordship had taken care to destroy the evidences of Lady Lucy Darnley's first marriage with Mr. Eveline, which had been celebrated with all its proper forms, and the banns regularly published, by suborning the clerk to tear the leaf containing the register out of the church books, the marriage could not be proved, and I was bastardized by my own mother's uncle, and our cause fell to the ground. My father's grief and distress may be imagined. It took such an effect upon his health that he survived my mother only 2 years. Destitute as I now was of fortune and rank, I yet never wanted a friend. My uncle, Mr. Hamilton, received me into his house, and treated me like his son, and from that time I assumed his name. A secret hope always pervaded my mind that Lord Somertown's heart would be touched with remorse for his injustice to me, and that he would restore me to my just rights by permitting the man to return who had been sent abroad by his means, and whose testimony, as a witness to the marriage, would have been sufficient to reinstate me in the privileges he had deprived me of. In this expectation, however, I was deceived. His malice still pursued me, and although he did not know that I had assumed the name of Hamilton, nor had been able to ascertain what asylum sheltered me, his endeavours to penetrate the mystery never relaxed, until a report of my death being industriously spread by my friends, his lordship rejoicing in the extinction of his enemy, deemed himself happy in the consummation of his wishes. The present Duke of Albemarle's father was then the possessor of my just rights, and Lord Somertown, who stood in the same relationship to him as to my mother, was afterwards appointed guardian to his son, the present Duke, by his will made on his deathbed. Of my relationship or connection with Mr. Hamilton, Lord Somertown heard nothing, as he had always been too proud to investigate my father's family, and the report of my death precluded suspicion. I grew up, therefore, in the neighbourhood of his family seat, without his ever entertaining an idea of my existence. When I was about 19, I came home for the summer vacation from Oxford, and Mr. Hamilton received me with more than usual satisfaction in his countenance. "I am far from despairing," said he, "of seeing you restored to your just rights, if your inclinations should lead you to second my wishes. But remember, before I communicate what those wishes are, I disclaim all intention of putting the least force upon your affections." I was at a loss to guess what this prelude was to lead to. But my good uncle soon put the matter past a doubt by telling me that Lord Summertown had a granddaughter that resided with him, who was the most beautiful creature he ever beheld, but whose birth was attended with such circumstances of misfortune that it is but too probable his lordship may find it difficult to marry her to his satisfaction. "You," added my uncle, "are supposed to be my son. Your fortune in that case must be immense. Lord S. does not suspect who you really are, and as no reasonable objection can be made either to your family or fortune, in your present character, I intend to propose the alliance, provided you should be as much enchanted with the lovely Emily as I am. If you are accepted, it will be an agreeable surprise to Lord S. to find, when you have married his granddaughter, that you are the lawful heir of such rank and fortune as that which certainly belongs to you. Nor do I entertain a doubt that he will immediately produce such proofs as will reinstate you in your rights." This scheme appeared so romantic, and my dislike to Lord Summertown was so deeply rooted in my heart, that I could scarcely have patience to hear my uncle to the end of his speech. When he paused, I said, "You leave me free to do as I like, my dear sir, and therefore I decline having anything to do with such a wretch as Lord S. Let him keep his malice, and leave me my resentment. I could not love a granddaughter of his, I am sure, were she as beautiful as he be." Vain boast, of the fallacy of which I was soon after made sensible. The lovely Emily was kept in such seclusion that it might almost be styled captivity, all the privilege she enjoyed beyond the state of a prisoner being the liberty of walking sometimes in her grandfather's park, and even that indulgence was restricted to an early hour in the morning. During these rambles she was attended by the governess who had brought her up, and who doted upon her. It chanced one morning in the shooting season that I strolled near the precincts of Sheldon Park. My dogs sprung a covey of partridges, who, in their flight, made toward a small enclosure adjoining to the park gate, the interior of which was screened from my view by a plantation of young trees. With the eagerness of a young sportsman, I discharged my gun, and was preparing to climb the fence in search of my game, when loud shrieks from within filled me with consternation and dismay. I scarcely knew how I got to the spot from whence they proceeded, but when I reached it my terror was increased rather than diminished, for I beheld a female figure stretched on the ground, covered with blood, and apparently lifeless, whilst another was bending over her in an agony of terror not to be described. I too plainly perceived that I was the unfortunate cause of the accident, and I hastened to offer my assistance to the distressed lady. She raised her head to thank me, and discovered a countenance in which was drawn the strongest picture of grief I ever beheld. "My beloved child," exclaimed she, "is wounded, I fear mortally. Let me entreat you, sir, to assist me in conveying her to the porter's lodge, which is not far from hence." I stooped to lift the young lady from the ground. Her hat had fallen off, and her face was shaded by her redundant locks. But when, with the assistance of the elderly lady, I raised her from her lowly bed, heavens, what a beauty struck my senses! Pale as she was, with dishevelled locks, and her garments stained with the crimson stream of her blood, yet was she the most lovely object I had ever beheld. My heart died within me as I bore the lifeless burden to the place her governess had pointed out to me, for I firmly believed she had breathed her last. When we reached the porter's lodge, the lovely Emily, for it was herself, was laid upon the bed, and a man dispatched on horseback to fetch the nearest surgeon, a distance of 3 miles. I will not pretend to describe the agony I suffered during the time the sweet girl remained in a lifeless state. I stood the very image of despair, close to the door of the chamber in which she was laid, waiting the sentence of my future happiness or misery. At length I had the unspeakable joy of hearing the delightful exclamation from her attendants that she revived. And shortly afterwards my rapture was increased by the silver tones of her own sweet voice inquiring where she was. Her governess then came to me and assured me that Miss Hinchcliffe, that was the name my Emily bore, was much better, and that she could venture to pronounce, without seeing the surgeon, that the wounds she had received were of no material consequence. My joy was now as extravagant as my grief had been acute, and I was almost in a delirium from the excess of the emotion that I had suffered. When the surgeon arrived, his testimony confirmed Mrs. Bolton's favorable opinion, for he pronounced the wounds, which were in the fleshy part of the arm, not at all dangerous, and assured us that the fainting fit in which the lovely Emily had lain so long was occasioned by terror more than by loss of blood. Time will not permit me to dwell on the events that followed this accident, by which I was introduced to the arbitress of my fate, and became enamoured of the very woman I had declared to my uncle I could never love. The distress I had shown on this occasion excited an interest for me in the heart of the beauteous Emily. At first the excuse of inquiring after her health, and entreating her to forgive the injury I had unwittingly done her, served to apologize for the liberty I took in waylaying her morning rambles. By degrees she came to expect my visits, and soon ventured gently to reproach my negligence if by any accident I was later than usual in making my appearance. Mrs. Bolton, who longed for the emancipation of her pupil from the tyranny she groaned under, gave every encouragement to my addresses, and by this imprudent act laid the foundation for the future misery of the person she loved best in the world. To be brief, our attachment was mutual, and we exchanged vows of unalterable fidelity to each other. I now entreated my uncle to make the proposal to Lord Summertown he had before suggested, explaining to him at the same time the cause of this sudden change in my opinion. My uncle shrugged up his shoulders and sighed. "How perverse is human nature!" said he. "What is attainable we always despise, whilst those things that are beyond our reach are generally the object of our wishes. At the time I proposed the alliance to you, there appeared to be no impediment to the union. You then were averse to the proposal, and I let the subject drop, little supposing you would happen to wish to renew it at the moment when I am convinced it is impossible. Lord Summertown's inflexibility to all endeavours at thwarting his will is almost proverbial. Whatever he has said shall be, is like the laws of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not. An attempt, therefore, to turn him from his designs is really akin to madness. I have just learned from undoubted authority that there is an alliance for his granddaughter now on the tapis. The lover is Lord Balafin of Balafin Castle in Ireland. And as he has never seen the lady, it must be the fortune the grandfather has promised her that is the object of his affections. I was struck dumb by this intelligence, and almost ready to sink into the ground. As soon as I had recovered myself a little, however, I entreated my uncle not to let a vague report, which might originate in the fertile brain of some gossiping matchmaker, deter him from making the proposal I was now so eager about. adding, with all the sanguine confidence of a youthful lover, that as my fortune exceeded that of Lord B., it was more than probable, if money was Lord Summertown's object, he might be inclined to favor my suit in preference to his lordship's. My uncle shook his head, but nevertheless promised to make the application. He did so, and was rejected in the most positive terms by Lord Summertown, who assured him that Miss Hinchcliffe was disposed of already. "She knows nothing of my intentions as yet," added his lordship sternly, "but it is time enough. When she knows my will, she must obey it. I am therefore in no doubt about what she may think of the proposal. Her business is to obey, not to question." When my uncle conveyed this fatal news to me, my agony was beyond expression, and it was a long time before I could give utterance to my feelings. When I did speak, it was only to renew my vows of never marrying anybody except Emily. My uncle entreated me to abandon all ideas of so mad an intention, and recall to my remembrance the sorrows of my unfortunate parents, as well as those of the hapless Emily. This argument had no effect, however, with me. Misery appeared in no way so certain as in a separation from her I loved, and could I but obtain the object of my affection, the world appeared a cheap price to pay for such an inestimable treasure. When I had an opportunity of conversing with Emily, and imparting my sentiments to her upon our cruel situation, it was some consolation to me to find her as willing as myself to brave the frowns of the world and the dangers of poverty, rather than relinquish the sweet hope of being united. The same romantic affection inspired us both, and under its dangerous influence we acted so as to entail irremediable evil on ourselves and our offspring. Lord Summertown had not the least suspicion of our attachment, and imagined that my uncle's proposal, whose son he supposed me to be, had been made for the alliance with a view of aggrandizing his family. This unfortunate blindness on Lord Summertown's part was but too favorable to our secret correspondence, and we continued to meet without hindrance or suspicion. At length the dreaded proposal was made in person by Lord Balafin, and his lordship introduced to Emily, who was informed by her grandfather that she must look upon his lordship as her future husband, without a single question being asked her whether he was agreeable to her or not. The day after this dreadful meeting, my beloved Emily appeared in such distress and terror of mind that it drove me almost to madness, and in the insanity of the moment I proposed a clandestine marriage to her. "There is not," said I, "any danger of our union being set aside, if we can once accomplish it, as I am of age, and it will be easy to get the banns published without Lord Summertown's knowledge, who never goes to church." Emily listened to me with complacency, and I soon prevailed with her to consent to the measure, which was immediately adopted. I gave a very large sum of money to the clergyman and also to the clerk, and by that means obtained the secrecy I wished for. The former had a great impediment in his speech, which defect he managed so dexterously as to render our names totally unintelligible to the congregation. Our being asked in church was unnoticed, a circumstance that was considerably assisted by several other couples being asked at the same time. Not long afterwards, during a short absence of Lord Summertown from Sheldon Park, we were married, and fondly flattered ourselves that we were now safe from the tyranny we dreaded. Alas, we had forever riveted the chains that bound us, and given our enemies a power to hurt us they could not otherwise have possessed. About 3 months after our marriage, Emily received orders to prepare herself to become a bride, and she was directed to make the necessary purchases for her nuptials. It was in vain that the poor girl implored her inexorable parent to listen to her for a few minutes. He spurned her from him, telling her that no reply was necessary on her part, as she had nothing to do, now she knew his will, but to obey it. "Lord Sheldon," said he, "is coming from Saxony, whither he had been sent on a diplomatic mission, and when he returns your marriage will take place immediately. Lord Balafin intends being here the latter end of this month, and I desire, as you value your future happiness, to clear up that dismal countenance, and receive him in a manner suitable to my wishes." Poor Emily could make no reply to this peremptory command, but quitting the room as fast as her trembling limbs would permit her, she sought the refuge of her own chamber, and there, on the bosom of her faithful friend Mrs. Bolton, she poured out the anguish of her heart. The terror and agitation the sweet girl suffered on this trying occasion brought on a most alarming illness, and for many days her life was despaired of. Think what must have been my sufferings when I knew that the beloved object of all my hopes in this world lay at the point of death, and I did not dare to approach her pillow, to whisper one word of tender consolation in her ear. The kind-hearted Mrs. Bolton did all she could to mitigate my anxiety, and gave me regular information 3 or 4 times a day. And every night, during my Emily's extreme danger, I watched beneath her window, disguised in the coarse frock and slouched hat of a ploughman, who, being frequently employed to watch the poachers, excited no suspicion by being seen lurking about in the dead of night. End of Part 1 of Chapter 28.